Good morning, good morning. Okay, I think this is our fifth Skype Shiur to Australia, and we'll begin with a question that we received from the Kollel concerning bakeries. And this question will serve as an introduction to Rabbi Gorelick, who's on my left side here, Rabbi David Gorelick, who one of the many things that he does at the OU is take care of Yoshan. And to my right is Rabbi Eli Gersten, who is the OU rabbinic coordinator for Psak and policy. He works with the Poskim. He just finished a session with Rav Belsky Shlita. So he will address, most of the questions will be addressed to Rabbi Gersten. However, the first question is one about Yoshan, and Rabbi Gorelick will respond with a entire introduction to the whole Indian of Yoshan. The question is that the Mishnah Berurah in Or HaChaim rules that ideally one should be stringent and eat Yoshan. And if so, what is the reason that many Echsherim are lenient and allow Chodosh? Rabbi Gorelick.
Thank you very much. Just as one sentence of introduction, what I'm about to discuss with you, I don't know if it applies to Australia. What I'm going to discuss pertains to mainly the United States, a little bit Canada, and hopefully it will be of assistance to you. The source for the laws pertaining to Chodosh and Yoshan are found in Vayikra. And these laws are applicable to the Chamesh Haminim, barley, oats, rye, spelt, and wheat. The laws of Chodosh do not apply to other grains such as rice, corn, and buckwheat. The grains of the Chamesh Haminim are Yoshan if they took root prior to Pesach. If they don't take root prior to Pesach, they are Chodosh until the following Pesach. There's a halachic discussion whether the grain must take root 3 days or 2 weeks prior to Pesach. There's a dispute amongst the Tanoim whether the Torah prohibits Chodosh outside Eretz Yisrael. The Rif, the Rambam, and the Tur adopt a stringent opinion, and it's also the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. Therefore, one must be sure that Yoshan grains are consumed. However, the Poskim note that the prevalent custom in Europe was to be lenient on this matter. Various reasons are given to justify this approach. Some suggest that in some countries we can rely on the fact that most grain takes root prior to Pesach. This is especially true in the United States, where 75% of the wheat planted is winter wheat, and winter wheat by definition is Yoshan. Some utilize Sfek Sveka. Maybe the crop is from the previous year. And even if it is from this year's crop, then perhaps it took root prior to Pesach. Some argue that there are a number of cumulative factors to consider. Since obtaining Yoshan was extremely difficult in Europe, and the grains that presented a problem were a staple to their diet, this situation could be viewed as a shas hadchak. Furthermore, there are opinions that Chodesh is forbidden midrabbonim. Therefore, one could apply the rule that Sufek drabbonim lakula in the case of doubt. So therefore, we can be lenient on this Issa drabbonim. In addition, flour is difficult to store because of potential infestation. The Aruch HaShulchan cites the Or Zeruah, who argues that the nature of the prohibition of Chodosh in Chutz La'aretz lacks a conclusive resolution, since the Gemara does not offer a definitive psak. He maintains that in such situations one may rely on the lenient position for Chodosh in Golos. The Aruch HaShulchan further suggests that according to this opinion, the prohibition of Chodosh of outside of Eretz Yisrael would only be applicable to lands in close proximity to Israel, as opposed to more distant countries. He compares it to Truma and Meiser, where the Chachamim applied Niser only to lands adjacent to Eretz Yisrael. Others discuss whether the prohibition applies only to Jewish-owned land or whether it includes non-Jewish ownership as well. In the United States, most barley and oats are Chodosh, since they do not take root before Pesach. Canadian oats are also Chodosh, and the United States imports a significant amount. Domestic rye is always Yoshan, However, rye bread can be chadosh since it is primarily composed of spring wheat. Spelt grown in the United States and Canada Spelt grown in the United States and Canada are yoshon. Wheat has both a winter and a spring crop. Winter wheat is yoshon since it takes root prior to Pesach. Spring wheat is usually chadosh since it does not always take root before Pesach. Different wheats yield different types of flour. For example, low gluten flour is used for crumbly products such as cookies, matzah, and pretzels, and the flour comes from winter wheat. However, high gluten flour is used for chewy products such as bread, challah, and pizza and bagels, and this is produced from spring wheat. Malt is derived from barley, which can be chadosh. The malt is added to wheat flour for baking applications. The amount added is usually less than 1% by volume. The malt enhances the chemical reaction of the flour, yeast, and water, allowing the dough to rise better. Barley malt is added to all barley and grocery flour. Flour made especially for baking cakes and cookies does not contain malt. Barley malt can be added to some foods for coloring and flavoring. These products include pretzels, candies, cereals, such as cornflakes, beer, vodka, and a couple of other items as well. There is a halachic discussion whether the malt added to these products can be considered bottle. The Chadosh malt enters the marketplace in the United States around December 15th. There is no concern of Chadosh in white vinegar since it does not contain barley malt. However, specialty vinegars such as malt vinegar, tarragon vinegar, and salad vinegar are exceptions. Matzah meal is ground matzah and is therefore yoshon, since matzah is produced from winter wheat. Rye crackers are yoshon, provided that the wheat, oats, and malt listed in the ingredient panel are also yoshon. One must be also careful about oatmeal cookies, since both the oats and wheat flour must be yoshon. Pizza stores sometimes line the oven walls with semolina flour, so in addition to the flour for the pizza itself, one has to be concerned that the semolina flour is also yoshon. Products from Eretz Yisrael bearing a reliable hechsher are yoshon. Products imported into Israel are not necessarily yoshon. If a package has several hashgachas and also states that the product is yoshon, one must find out which kashrus agency assures responsibility for its yoshon status. As far back as the 1930s, domestic wheat was stored and was therefore yoshon. During the 1950s, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal became the Rav HaMachshir of Sprite's products. Before accepting the position, Rav Aaron investigated the milling process and flour sources. The inquiry was important to Rav Aaron since he himself was machmir to eat only yoshon. He found that domestic wheat was not always stored, and consequently one can no longer assume that the flour in the marketplace was yoshon. For the interim, Rav Aaron ate matzah instead of bread until he purchased the freezer to store the various products needed to produce yoshon home-baked goods. Consequently, Rav Aaron informed Streitz that he would provide hashkocha only if all their products were yoshon, and the company agreed to the provision. When Rav Aaron later moved to Chicago, he convinced the bakery to become yoshon, and eventually other bakeries in Chicago followed suit. A Rav Yitzchak Giffenzal, a Talmud of Rav Aaron, guided these bakeries in observing yoshon. In the 1970s, other individuals became concerned when the United States began selling its surplus wheat to Russia. The domestic storage was depleted, and one could no longer assume that the flour was yoshon. Due to this situation, Rabbi Yosef Herman of Muncie, New York, began compiling information about the yoshon status of domestic grains. Because of his diligence, more people have access to yoshon information, and it is easier to observe the mitzvah. When Rabbi Herman first began gathering information, he used the halachic principle of Mesech Lefitumo, relying on information from a non-Jew unaware of the halachic importance of the issue. The companies would inform him about packing days, best used buy dates, and purchase dates. This information helped determine the chadosh or yoshon status of a product. Recently, Rabbi Herman decided that Meseich Lefutumo would no longer be applicable since the companies are now aware of the significance of the yoshon market. Therefore, Rabbi Herman determines the chadosh status based on the United States Department of Agriculture crop progress reports, unless he has information from a mashkiach or kashrus agency. He calculates the earliest possible date that the products can be considered chadosh. As a result, he has earlier cutoff dates than in the past. However, there are rabbanim who have ruled that if different companies provide the same information, then we may assume that they are telling the truth. Therefore, if they state that the new crop is entering the food chain at a later date, then we may rely on that information. In order to observe yoshon, one must store the products properly. If flour is not stored in the refrigerator, infestation can occur. The eggs of the flour beetle enter the mill attached to the wheat. Flour mill companies have a cleaning system to remove virtually all the eggs. The remaining eggs are able to hatch live beetles, which have a life cycle of 21 days. The probability of the eggs hatching is increased as the storage time and storage temperature increase. In addition, worms can enter the flour bags even if the opening is extremely minute. Therefore, it is imperative to refrigerate the flour, to be certain the bags have no openings, and to maintain cleanliness. There are flour companies that have worked closely with the OU to provide yoshon flour. This is done for 50 and 100 pound bags. Since companies mill both spring and winter wheat, Rabbi Yisrael Belsky Shlita of the OU established that yoshon wheat must be sealed in its own bins before the arrival of the chadosh wheat to prevent the potential mixture of flours. When the company wants to make a yoshon production, the mashkiach releases the yoshon wheat for the run. The next key step is cleaning the equipment from the previous chadosh productions. The best method to clean the equipment is with a wet wash. The problem is that the flour milling companies rarely wet wash the equipment. Therefore, the equipment is cleaned by flushing it with yoshon flour and labeling the first pallet chadosh. The subsequent pallets are then labeled yoshon. The mashkiach is on site to confirm that the flush is labeled chadosh. Rabbi Belsky felt that this method would be sufficient to remove the chadosh and overcome the halacha principle of Dover Sheish Lo Matirin. Rabbi Herschel Schechter Shlito, who also is a halacha consultant of the OU, also maintains that there is a limit to an Iser Mashehu. He argues that if a drop of chametz fell into a reservoir, the water may still be used on Pesach. Similarly, the minuscule amount of chadosh that might be left would not prohibit the use of the yoshon flour. The OU policy is that equipment that was used to make chadosh products using heat must be Eino Ben Yomo in order to make yoshon products. This policy is based on the Shagas Aryeh's opinion that chadosh is a Torah prohibition, even in Chutz La'aretz, and therefore the standard rules of Tam Kikur apply. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik also required that the utensils be Eino Ben Yomo.
Shkoyach Rabbi Gorelick for that very comprehensive review of yoshon in North America. One of the things you mentioned was finding bugs in flour, and that leads us to our next question for Rabbi Gersten. Why is it forbidden to eat bugs found in flour? Yes?
That's the question?
Yeah, go on.
This flush, if you flush it with yoshon, remove all the most of the would that be a problem with the fact that if anything is left over?
We're not concerned about that. We're not concerned about that based on what I had said earlier from the psukim of Rabbi Belsky and Rabbi Schechter.
What do you say, right?
Yeah, no, I just want to comment on that. I've discussed this, Shiloh. Rabbi Belsky has also a slightly different approach to why it's okay. He says that the flush that we do, when you do a flush, it's not only that you're mixing in and you're being further being mevatel, but rather it pushes out all the flour that's already in there. He says there's no there's no way to prove one way or the other, but there's a possibility that there's nothing remaining from the original chadash. And as far as why it's not a problem of davar sheyesh lamatirin, he says that davar sheyesh lamatirin is where there's going to be something left over. Over here, there's a possibility that everything is pushed out. When they go further than what Rabbi Gorelick said, it's not that when they don't do a wet wash, that doesn't mean they don't clean out the mills. They do clean them out, but they don't clean them out with water. They clean them out. They have to do a dry cleaning. So they have to use vacuums and brushes, and but it comes out pretty clean. But that being said, there could still be a little bit left behind. That little left, they're then sending through. You mentioned one pallet, but there's a certain amount that whatever, you know, pallet is a term that refers to a certain quantity. It's a tremendous amount that they push through. Oftentimes, these companies will put through a lot more than that because it's not worth their time to once they're doing it, they'll just say, okay, this whole this day's production we're not going to use. We'll use tomorrow. I mean, I know from different speaking to people, they often do. A great amount of flour is pushed through. So by the time we're done doing this whole cleanliness and then this flush, so Rebelsky's argument is it's not a bittel. Bittel is where I have something left over in the end, and I'm saying that it's I'm dismissing it because of this quantity. Here he's saying I've cleaned it. There's nothing left. So it sort of works in with what Rav Schechter is saying as well, that at that point there's nothing. You know, even if there be some minuscule amount, we would say we're not concerned about that. But just trying to give you an idea of how minuscule we're talking about, because we're talking about there might be zero. That's how minuscule.
Getting back to eating bugs found in flour, the Shulchan Aruch rules that they are only forbidden if they have separated from the flour and crawl on the ground, which is probably not relevant to flour packed in a commercial process, and therefore the question, why is it forbidden to eat the bugs found in flour?
Right, that's actually a very interesting question. So what you're referring to is the Shulchan Aruch. That's what it says over there in Shulchan Aruch, that it's only usher when they're reichish al karka. The Neisei Kelim, though, say that it's not doime to the Shach. All the Neisei Kelim over there say it does not have the same status as water. Actually, I believe it's the Pri Chodesh is Mekel and says it holds it does have the same status as water, that even if they're Reichish on the sides of the Kli, it's also, that's considered Hein Revise, and it's not a problem. Basically, all the other Pais can reject that idea, and they say that once it's Reichish outside, on the sides, it's already Aser. Okay, one might say, well, that's maybe not a common thing to happen. So two things to respond to that. First of all, if you look in the Chochmas Adam, so the Chacham Zadim says that, first of all, we're chayshish even if it's reichish through the flour. That's considered from one speck of flour, I guess, to the next, is already considered like mi tamara le tamara, that it's already considered that it was reichish ala karka. So it doesn't have to actually leave the bag and sort of go onto the floor in order for it to be a problem. The lashon of the Chacham Zadim over here is, filu im loy shirtzu rak bekemach gufa gam ke mikri pirish kamoi pirish mi pri lepri. Okay, this is in klal lamed ches in the halachas of talayim. And then but moreover in the binas adam he goes even further and he says that even though we said that being reichish ala kli is only a suffix, but it's a suffix that we're chayshish for. So we can't say that maybe it wasn't reichish ala kli. We don't view that as a, I guess you'd say it's a suffix deraisa. So if you find toloyim in the flour, we would have to be chayshish that they were reichish ala kli, and therefore it's aser. Now that being said, that's all in terms of where we do find bugs. If we're not chayshish in places where we don't have to be concerned that the flour has bugs in it, so you look in the Bina Sadam, and even in the Chacham Sadam himself, he says that it does qualify. This could qualify for a situation of Sfek Sfeka. Maybe the bugs aren't there at all, and maybe even if they are, maybe they weren't Reichish. But again, that's a separate Shiloh. The question was asked, if there are bugs, why are they okay? Why can't we permit them because they weren't Reichesh Alakarka? So the basic understanding is that either because we're always choshish that they were Reichesh Alakarka, meaning on the sides, or because even in through the flower itself, that's already enough of a rechisha to make them usher.
And we'll go into some of the practical details of this in the next question for Rabbi Gorelick, which is about sifting flour. This is three parts to this question, and they're all interrelated. First part, A, is it necessary to sift flour, and does this vary in different regions? Part B, if one is obligated to sift flour, how long after the grinding of the flour must one suspect that infestation has occurred? And part C, when one sifts flour, how soon afterwards does one have to use the flour before being concerned with reinfestation?
Concerning the different regions, we have found in the United States that there's no need to re-sift because the companies have such a good process to destroy the eggs, so therefore we do not have a concern about it under good storage conditions. The key is the storage conditions. If the room is warm, or if you hold on to it for a long time, or as I mentioned before, if there's a hole in the bag, anything can happen. So it is best, even in the United States, that one should store the flour in as cool a location as possible and make sure that it's clean and there are no holes in the bag, and also in an area where there's no heat. That is the key, because the heat limits the shelf life of the flour and also increases the potential for infestation. In Eretz Yisrael, the custom is to re-sift, but again, as I mentioned before, in the United States, that problem doesn't exist. So one doesn't have to re-sift in the United States, provided that the person keeps it in proper storage conditions and uses it as soon as possible to prevent heat from affecting it.
Thank you, Rabbi Gorelick. Rabbi Gersten, the Shach in Yoredeya rules that bread from a Jewish-owned bakery, which was baked by a non-Jew, has no heter of pas akum. Is the custom to be lenient in this matter, according to the Baal Igros Moish in Yoredeya Simen Mem Hei?
That is the minig. I see that everyone's familiar here with that tshuva of Moshe. So, basically, he differentiates between commercial bakery versus, let's say, like a retail type shop or small mom and pop bakery. His argument is that in a place where it's a large commercial bakery, the baking cannot be done by just the owner alone. He needs lots of workers in order to run all the lines and all the different machinery that needs to be done. And therefore, he says that it's not a the gzeira does not apply to such a case. The whole issue is, well, why isn't he just doing it himself? Why, if it's a passive yid, he should bake it himself. And since here it's not really practical for him to do it all himself, he needs workers, so therefore it would be like every other paspalter. If it's a small operation, it's just a one-person show or one or two people working in the bakery, that's a different story. Then that type of a question could come up. So, in the OU, we don't give a hechsher on any retail bakeries. We're only dealing in commercial bakeries. So by us, the question really doesn't come up.
The next question, Rabbi Gersten, is it permissible?
The cooler, the better. There are people who put their flour in the fridge or freezer to prevent the problem. It doesn't mean that it's a must to put it in such cool conditions, but at least we deal here in the United States with Fahrenheit. If it's the warmer the Fahrenheit, 70 degrees and above, one is asking for trouble. So it's best to find as cool a room as possible. And if one can't keep it really cool, then one has to use it quickly. Relatively, it's hard to put a number on it, a temperature number, or the swiftness that one should use it. But the thought that one should bear in mind is the warmer the situation, the more problematic it could become.
Is it permissible, Rabbi Gersten, for a Jew to turn on an oven through a time switch that will control the oven to turn on and off automatically for an extended period of time?
Okay, so if by extended period of time means what I think it means, so I'll explain. So then the answer is no. One may not do that. Obviously, this is an issue comes up if you want to have Pas Yisrael in a bakery. So you'd have to have a mashgiach go every single morning and light the fire. Now, that could be very difficult to arrange such a situation. So people are trying to look for shortcuts. One of them is, well, I'll set a timer every 4 a.m. or whenever the bakery opens. The fire goes on, and I'll set that timer once, and it'll be Pas Yisrael forever. So Rebelsky says, no, that does not work, because the use of a timer in that manner is a grumma. That's not enough of a contribution of an involvement of the Yisrael to consider that he's involved in the baking. However, if he wants to use a timer, let's say Mashgiach will be there till closing at 8 o'clock in the evening. He's not going to be around at 4 a.m. to turn on the fires for them. He wants to set a timer every evening that will turn on the fires at 4 a.m. Let's say he comes in when the bakery opens for, later on. I don't know. Let's say the mashgiach only comes in at 8, but they start baking at 4. So then that would be okay. He could set the timer as a delay, as a one-time delay. Once we start having something becoming cyclical, even a second time, I turned on the fire. Okay, so you could say that the delay of that is still my Maase Yisrael that I did. But now once you have, the non-Jew then turns off the oven, and because of that, because of the timer, it gets switched back on again. That type of an activity is just really not sort of now, whether I'm lighting a fire or anything is sort of no longer a direct Maase. We'll call it just a grumma. So then Rebelsky says you cannot do that. So again, one-time use, yes, and extended use is not. So that's what you meant by an extended period of time. To do it long-term, even 2 days' worth, you cannot do.
If an oven is turned on by a Jew, Rabbi Gersten, who is Michal Shabbos, the Jew is Michal Shabbos before Hesia, is the bread considered Pas Yisrael?
Okay, so the Piskei Tshuva discusses the Shaila. I think it's Tiferes L'Moshe, that we are Mekel, that we consider that to be Pas Yisrael. However, that's in theory. In practice, it's very difficult to arrange that because how do I know that it was... if you had a bakery where there was only one person, just the baker alone, who's the only person who works there, and he's Michal Shabbos, so then maybe you can have such an arrangement where, sort of by default, we know that he's the one turning on the oven. But usually the way it would work is you'd have many workers in a bakery, and let's say there's one person there who's not a Shomer Shabbos, and you were to designate and say, okay, he's the one that has to turn on the ovens, so how do we know that he did it? Maybe it was someone else who did it. There's no way, there's no nemunas over here. So in practice, it's not done. We don't really rely on it. In theory, though, the Paiskim discuss it. In fact, the Paiskim haven't even... I don't think that they really disagree. There's not much of a disagreement when it comes to Pass. It seems that it's basically accepted. But there's a big discussion in terms of Bishul, whether we consider it... if a non-Shomer Shabbos cooks, is that considered Bishul Akum or not? That's a big discussion in the Paiskim. Many Paiskim are Mekel, many Paiskim are Machmer. In fact, they bring rayas from the same cases, they find interesting places to bring rayas from. There's Chayla on Shabbos, if you have a sugya of, if a person cooks on Shabbos, bemeis it. So it says the food is mutter, lachar Shabbos. So some place can bring a raya from there that you see, what about Bishul Akum? The guy was Michal Shabbos, he cooked on Shabbos, bemeis it. And still you see the food is mutter. So there are places to bring. There are achrayim that say you see from there a raya. The Prima Gadim says no, it's not a raya. Maybe it's talking about foods that are not olal shulchan melachim. But there are many rayas brought back and forth. A lot of the Paiskim discuss that child when it comes to Bishul Akum. Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi Gerstner. Next question we'll ask Rabbi Gorelick. What separation does the OU require for a bakery which produces parva and dairy or meat products, both for the baking area as well as in the shop. Does such a bakery require additional supervision, such as a mashgiach tmidi?
A mashgiach tmidi would be necessary because all the potential pitfalls that could occur, because the bakery is producing parv dairy meat or some sort of combination or options, and in order to prevent any pitfalls, a mashgiach tmidi is necessary.
And what about the separation?
We would ideally want completely separation as well, because again, there's so many pitfalls that can occur. Separation is crucial.
Okay, Rabbi Gersten, what is the custom regarding separating challah from dough that was kneaded only with fruit juice?
Okay, so in terms of the chiyuv challah on such a thing, the Shulchan Aruch writes that it's chayiv and challah. This is a discussion in the Rishayim. The Shach himself brings right over there. Whether the Shita Sarosh is that if you only mafresh in with Sharmashkim, that it's not chayiv and challah. Discussion which Sharmashkim they're referring to. They're referring to including the Zayin Mashkim, maybe not including this, maybe excluding the Zayin Mashkim. But anyway, the Seif is that it is chayiv and challah. The Shulchan Aruch paskins that we're chayiv and challah. The question that then comes up though is, well, if I didn't use any of the Zayim Ashkim, the challah might be challah tahira, and then I can't burn it. It's not hochshel kabel tuma. Most of the time, this is not really a question, because flour is if you're using white flour, it's going to be tempered, and that means that they lasisa, they wash it. So the grains, the grains have already been wet. They've already been hochshel lekabel tuma, and therefore it doesn't matter if I use any of the zayim mashkim when I knead this dough. It's going to be tame anyways. So there's no problem in terms of when I'm afrish, in terms of burning the challah. That won't be an issue. Where this does come up is by egg matzah, because egg matzah, you can't do lasisa, you can't have any water. So if I use Zayim Ashkim, you could use Zayim Ashkim. So if I kneaded it with grape juice, for instance, then the egg challah would be the egg matzah would be would be tame, and then I would be able to burn it. If I used let's say just apple juice, eggs, then I have this question. I'll end up with challah tahira, and then you'll have a problem. You won't be able to burn it. So you'd have to be mafrish, but you can't burn it. One does with it is you'd have to set it aside and let it spoil. Unless you find the kayin, who's tevil, who wants to eat it, but the minig is not to do that bisman is there. So, really, there's no other etzah but to, just let it spoil. I guess if you're going to do this right before Pesach, then you're going to have a problem, because your egg matzah is probably not going to spoil. By the time Pesach comes, it'll turn into chametz. You have that, shiloh that the Mishnah discusses about whether, what do you do with it? But the egg matzahs are going to be made, long in advance of Pesach, bisman hazeh. The supermarkets are already well stocked with the egg matzahs weeks before Pesach, so there's plenty of time for the dough to spoil, and we don't really have that issue. We'll talk a little more about using the challah system that they do, which would also avert this problem.
Shai Rabbi Gersten, another question. Is the custom to require a formal minui shlichus from the owner of the bakery to the mashgiach in order to separate challah? This is based on a tzois achoshen in Choshen Mishpat Reish Mem Gimel. And if yes, does a new minui shlichus need to be made each day on the basis that it does not work for flour, which is not yet in the possession of the bakery?
Okay, so as far as getting initial minui shlichus from the yid, so then yes, we do that. We have them authorize the mashgiach to take challah. As is pointed out, that minui shlichus has a lifespan to it, but what it does help for is it helps that it shows that he has that's nichalei, that it's a schus. He considers it us taking challah for him to be a schus. And that the Rama says that we paskin that as long as it's nichalei, we could take challah. The Rama talks about if you have a meshareses in the house, somebody who you know, a cook or somebody, they could take the challah, even though you didn't give them a minu shlichus every day. You didn't. But since you obviously want them to, and maybe you even told them at one point, I want you to be taking challah for me. Therefore, that maker didn't. So we hold like the Rama that that is good enough. Now the question is asked: well, according to those that hold you need a minu shlichus, so then. They want to be machmir, so the Rama doesn't. The Rama is not going like that opinion. So, how does it help? Moreover, we don't say that it's a schus if it's. We only say zochin lo adam. We don't say zochin me adam. So zochin lo adam would mean I could give someone as a gift. I could be zeiche for them in something. But to take something away from them and say that it's a schus for them that I'm taking this away, so. That's a question. I believe the Ksais asks that you don't say Zachin Me'adam. So in a mafresh challah, well, I'm taking something away from them. So how do I do that? Again, you see from the Rama that he was not concerned about that. But the truth is today there's another Eitzah that they do which circumvents this problem of the Zachin Me'adam. And that is that the OU relies on this Hafrashas Challah system. I see it's referred to a similar variation on it in one of the later questions, actually in the very next question. Further on, I see next page. Okay, where the suggestion is, well, I'll have a large piece of dough, which is chayiv in challah, and I'll be mafrish from that on to my other pieces of dough. So the OU, what we do is we supply that piece that's chayiv in challah, and it goes... We supply it in the form of matzahs. Okay, they're already baked. The mile of using a matzah is a matzah has a very long shelf life. It won't spoil. So if I have these matzahs, I could put them there at the beginning of the year and they'll basically last there the whole year. Yeah. What?
Yeah.
Yeah, so these matzahs have not had challah been mafresh from them and therefore the tevel. And we have a nusach that we say that we're being mafresh from these tevel matzahs on each lisha as it will occur, and they repeat this lashon every day, and like this, I'm not taking anything away from his dough. The issue of being zochin me'adam that I'm removing some of his dough and he's losing out, and maybe he wanted me to take less, or maybe he wanted me to take from a different part of his dough, he didn't want that. We circumvent that problem because his dough is unaffected. It's a schus, and he told me it's a schus, and he authorized me that I can use this system for him. So we don't have that problem, and we don't have the problem of taking away. But in terms of an actual formal minui shlichus every day, no, that's obviously not practical, and we can't do. We have no way of doing that.
Another question for Rabbi Gorelick. What hecker is required on dairy baked goods? Does a hecker have to be made easily identifiable that the product is dairy, such as bearing a label which states dairy on it, or can it be a unique shape which is different than their parver products? I mean, in fact, Rabbi Gorelick, is a label with the word dairy on it sufficient?
From the OU perspective, the word dairy on the label will not suffice. The hecker must be in the bread itself. Either the word dairy is imprinted on it, which I don't think will happen too often, or the bread has a unique shape, which implies that it's a dairy bread, that only that shape implies dairy as opposed to parv.
Okay, back to Rabbi Gersten. Someone takes off challah from a batch of dough and some unused scraps of dough which were not used are returned to the next batch of dough. How do you avoid the problem that when taking challah off the next batch of dough, it shouldn't be min achiv al p'tur, min p'tur al achiv?
Okay, so again, because the OU uses our tevel matzah system, where we're always being mafresh from something that is vaday tevel, it So the question is not a problem. We're being mafresh on minachiyav alachiyav, and therefore, even if they were to mix back in dough into subsequent batters, it would not affect. It would not affect the it wouldn't be a problem.
Okay, Rabbi Gerson, when a Jew is not present at the time of a freshes challah, is it permissible to have a non-Jew separate some dough from every batch, put it aside, and when the Jew comes in at the end of the day, he takes challah from those set aside pieces? And the follow-up question is, a non-Jew believed that he took off dough from every batch and that none of the pieces were removed?
Right, so like we discussed earlier in terms of the namanos, you know, that's obviously going to be an issue over here as well. If he in fact did take off a piece from every dough, if you had, let's say, set up a video camera and you could see him taking off a piece from every dough and putting it on the side, then that would work. We could then be we could then be mafresh afterwards from all the pieces. However, lacking, you know, such a system, which, you know, I'm not aware of any places that have that, and then have to have somebody who actually, you know, has the time to go over the video and watch him do it. I guess you could do it in fast forward, maybe, and, you know, but I'm not aware of places that do it. So again, how do we mafresh from every place, from every lisha? We don't have a mashkiach at every time. We do it again with this challah system, with the tevel matzah system. And because we're having because we're using this separate piece of dough as what we're separating from, in fact, I see in the same question, it actually continues on over here. The questioner asked, are there alternatively acceptable methods how to separate challah when the mashkiach is not present at the time when every batch of dough is made, and then in parentheses, such as initially setting aside a large amount of dough and to always separate from that? So that indeed is what they do, and that takes good care of the problem.
If I'm correct, in the Nusach, they say that the next dough should go on the next area of the matzah, right?
Right, yes. There's a whole Nusach. I didn't bring it with me, but it explains, you know, when they say the Nusach, they're being mafresh on all the leashes that are going to be done and on the leashes that were done, and it ascribes a certain position on the matzah to where each hafrasha should take place from. So it's done in a similar way to way people are mafresh Trumas and Maestris. They talk about the north corner and the this and the south, and it's the same type of a system over here as well.
Okay, and next question, Rabbi Gersten, does the OU give Ashgacha to products advertised as mezonos rolls? And what criteria is necessary in order for a roll to be able to be labeled as a mezonos roll?
Okay, if it's made from rice, then it could be labeled mezonos roll. If it's not made from rice, then we would not label it as a mezonos roll. The reason being that, you know, first of all, even if it really would be mezonos, even let's say it has all the, everybody would agree that this roll is mezonos. It has very sweet, it's cake-like, it's crunchy, it's filling, you know, whatever all the definitions of pasba bekisnin or otherwise that one would accept to make something into a mezonos roll, it's still very misleading to call it a mezonos roll, because people would assume that means that even if I'm kaveh suda on this, for some reason, I don't need to bench. You know, they'll have at a kiddush or something, they'll have mezonos rolls, and it's a big michshol, because that's not, you know, even if it would be correct that the bracha would be mezonos, it's not helping for the way it's going to be used, or to serve it at a meal. They'll have an airline meal and they'll serve it together with a mezonos roll. Well, the person being kaveh suda on the mezonos roll, then they need to bench anyways. Aside from the fact that Rybalski disagrees with the idea of mezonos roll. In fact, he'd say it's not him who disagrees, the halacha disagrees with the idea of mezonos roll. So, you know, but the mezonos rolls, they don't taste sweet. They taste like bread. They don't meet the definitions of pasa baba kisnin. The reason for why they consider it a mezonos roll is because they're made with fruit juice instead of being made with plain water. So there are diukim in certain paiskim that makes a difference. But the Pashat reading of the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah, is that it has to be very sweet, even though maybe the Mechaber could be, those Sfaradim could be maybe slightly more mekel, because the Mechaber holds if there's sugar added, if it's sweet, a little bit of sweetness already, then you'd make a mezonos. But the Ramah says it has to be cake-like, it has to be like lekach, before you make a mezonos. He says our challahs are very sweet, and we still make a mitzi on them. So to... you know, as far as the OU is concerned, even though it's very popular among certain hashkachas to write mezonos rolls on everything, and there are mezonos bakeries, and there are mezonos, you know, everything is mezonos these days, Rebelsky will tell you that it's incorrect on a halacha basis, and it's incorrect on as far as being a mechshol to people in that, for instance, I'll give another example, you know, some pizzas will write on them berchasa mezonos. Well, you know, because they're made with fruit juice. So the OU doesn't allow that. Why? Because what does it mean, berchasa mezonos? I mean, pizza, if a person's kaveh suda, it's a maitzi. If they're not kaveh suda, it's mezonos. From whom am I putting in this row of fruit juice? What is it accomplishing? It's really just, it just confuses people as to what the purpose is. So maybe it's some sort of a chumrah that, you know, if I'm machmir, then maybe it's bread, and now I don't because it's fruit juice. Whatever the chumrah is, it's not interpreted by people that way. It's interpreted as a kula, and people then think that I could eat as much of this as I want, and I could be kaveh suda on it, and it's not going to be hamotzi. So again, if it's made from rice, that would be mezonos, and then that would be berchas mezonos. But otherwise, we wouldn't put that on there.
Thank you, Rabbi Gers. Yeah, we... Yes?
Sure. That's a great question. I'm not sure the answer. So I'm not going to put, you know, I mean, the truth is, Rebelsky himself will make a hamotzi on pizza. So
even one slice?
Yeah, even one slice. Because it's a shiloh, right? It's machlaikis. If you have a dough which is filled, but it's filled with meats or cheeses and things that are meal items, it's done for derech kviyasuda. So then that's not possible kisnin. I believe that's the taz. Only if it's filled with fruits sugary items, sweet things, dessert type items, that's when it's possible to kiss them. So that's a big machlaikis. I think the hachra of the Mishnah Berurah is that if it's something that's eaten as a snack type item, if it's eaten as a snack, so then it depends on the way it's the derech to eat that item. So something, for instance, those franks and blanks, where it's the derech to eat them only as a snack, no one's kaveh suda on franks and blanks. So that would be, even though it has meat inside, it would be a mezonos. But if it's something, meat pie, where it's something where a person would be kaveh suda on, and even though it has surrounded by dough, and even though it's meat inside, so that would be a hamaitzi. So I think it has to do with, Rebelsky says he's not moichah against those who would make a mezonos on it, because it's questionable. How one looks at pizza. Is pizza a snack? Is pizza a meal? So it's sort of right in the middle. Many people will tell you pizza is a snack, and many people will tell you pizza is a meal. But he himself views it as a meal item, and he would make a maitzi on it. But in terms of if it is, those who view it as a snack, how much a person has to eat, I don't know. I'm not sure what the exact amount that he would say. And it doesn't make a difference to children or adults. It does. That seems to be from the Paiskim, and the Mishnah Berurah also seems to differentiate. But I don't know. I don't have exact numbers.
Okay. Maybe we'll find out for Rebelsky what he holds, and we'll
send
you an email, follow up. Okay, we have two more questions that were submitted in advance, and then if we have a few more minutes, we could take questions from the floor. The next question is, what is the requirement, Rabbi Gersten, for checking eggs for blood spots in a commercial setting?
Okay, so today in bakeries, they don't crack eggs. We had actually, there's one of the rabbis here who deals with bakeries. He came to me a few months ago with a question that had to do with a bakery where they're cracking eggs. He says it's like the first time it's ever come across his desk, a bakery that cracks eggs. because any place that's in, you know, you're going to have to hire a person, a full-time, in any regular bakery, there'd have to be a full-time job of just an egg cracker. You know, it's just not, you know, you're paying a whole salary to somebody just so you can sit there cracking eggs. What they do in all, so in all commercial bakeries, they buy liquid egg. So it's the same idea, it's the same egg, but you buy it in bulk and it comes from a company that deals in eggs. That's what they do. They crack eggs and they have machinery that do it. And these egg companies, they have, I mean, this is true even if you buy, whole eggs. They have candling machines, and so there's no way to check. The only checking that could be done on liquid egg is at the egg producing company. Once you get it, there's nothing to check for. It's all liquefied. It's all mixed together. There's no way to check it for any blood spots at this point anymore. But the companies do have machinery that check for blood spots. They have called candling machines, and there's a certain percentage they could tell you, you know, how often it is and how much they find, and it basically corresponds. So they know they're getting out something like, you know, 99% of the blood spots. At least that's true for white eggs. For brown eggs, it's different because the candling isn't as effective. The color of the brown affects how well they're able to find the blood spots. But at least with white eggs, it's very, very effective because, these are machinery that are trained better than a human eye. It's all as fast as, you know, as a computer could think. You know, it decides whether there's a blood spot or not. So that's, you know, now in terms of whether really there's a chiyuv of checking for blood spots nowadays, Ramesh Feinstein and Igor Smysha has a tshuva about that. Really, Bizman Azed, there's really no need even to be looking for blood spots because our eggs are not fertilized. Even if they would be fertilized, they're taken immediately from the chicken as soon as they're laid, and they're refrigerated. They're put onto, you know, they're taken away. They're not incubated. In order for a blood spot from fertilization to form, it needs to be incubated for about 72 hours. So it needs to be kept under a certain amount of humidity and temperature, or it will not turn into a fertilized egg. Even if it was fertile, it wouldn't get a blood spot. But anyways, the chickens today are not allowed to become, they don't have roosters there, they're not fertilized. They're immediately, as soon as the egg is laid, they drop out onto conveyor belts that take them, whisk them away. They're refrigerated, they're not. So the whole question of real blood spots, of shadi tichla bakula, don't apply. If you're buying it from a roadside stand from some farmer, who knows what you're getting? But if you're talking about industrial, commercially, bakeries, so there's no checking in terms of the bakery again because it's liquid, and at the egg companies they do candling, and even that is really a chumrah.
And the final question we have concerning eggs: how does one avoid the problem of sakana of opened raw eggs left overnight in a commercial bakery setting?
Okay, so this is a very good question. Like we just mentioned, they're buying all the liquid egg. So this liquid eggs have been made, many days in advance. They'll do a certain type of pasteurization on the eggs. You can't obviously fully cook them, otherwise they'll turn into cooked eggs. But they are able to heat them up to a certain degree for a certain amount of time, and it kills off most of the bacteria. They're able to improve their shelf life. So, and the purpose of it, obviously, because the liquid eggs is going to not be used that day. It's going to stay overnight. It's going to take many days until it probably reaches the factory, the bakery, where it'll be used. It might remain in the bakery for several days before it's used. So, obviously, the question of sakana comes up. The OU relies on the tshuva, again, of Rav Moshe Feinstein. It's in Chelek Gimel of Yeridea Simen Chaf. And he's dealing with this very question. He's asked about the liquid eggs at bakeries. Is there an issue of sakana? And he passes over there that it's not a problem of sakana. If you want to read the whole tshuva, I would recommend that everybody, you know, should look it up themselves. I'll just tell you a brief synopsis of, you know, what the main point. But you know, it's good to see the whole thing yourself. His main point is that the issue of sakana by cracked eggs is because of Hesach Hadas. Hesach Hadas meaning that the person intended to use the egg today and then they forgot about it, it stayed overnight, and they want to use it tomorrow. That Hesach Hadas is what brings out the Ruach Ra. He says even if a person cracks an egg today and plans on using it tomorrow, that doesn't help, because it's the same scenario. It's the same. There's no difference between the first person and the second person. He says once the Chazal were geyser, it was across the board, and you need something to be a different heftza, something of a change in what you did. He says though, where you have it done in a factory where they're collecting thousands and thousands of eggs, filling up a large tankers even, you know, or large totes full of these eggs, and then they're sending it to the bakery where it'll be used, where it's not a matter of I could have used it today or I forgot about it today and I ended up using it tomorrow, but rather it's not possible to use it today. It's not that I just my intent, it has to do with my intention, but the whole system wouldn't work if it had to be used today. So he says that is a whole different system already, and he thinks that in that, such a case you can't talk about Hesach Hadas. Hesach Hadas is I could have used it today, I was going to use it, I forgot, you know, or something where it would be shayach to that type of a system, where I have a whole system based on long-term use. He says not shayach in such a case to Hesach Hadas. But anyway, I encourage every person to look up the tshuva themselves. Again, it's in Yeridei Chel Gimel Simin Chof.
Shkoyach Rabbi Gerson. This brings us to the close of the questions that were submitted. We opened the floor. We have exactly 2 minutes left. If there are any questions from Australia, now's your chance.
Thank you very much. It was a very enlightening share, and we appreciate the efforts of all the rabbanim who are here today to present the share. Could we ask, in a home setting, would Rav Moshe hold that a blood spot is required to throw out the entire egg?
Yes. Yes, that's what he writes in the tshuva. He says that the minig is that we throw, when we find the blood spot, we throw out the whole egg, even though we know that the blood spot is not from fertilization. He says that still, that the minig is still to throw away the entire egg. But again, so like in restaurants where you do have people cracking eggs, it's not correct to use the egg without if a blood spot is found. We have a, you know, the system that they work with over there. It's not shaykh for the mashkiach to crack all the eggs or to go around watching when anybody ever cracks an egg. But they have a system that they will give a dollar to anyone who finds an egg. Anyone who finds an egg.
Finds
a blood spot in an egg can bring it to the mashkiach, and the mashkiach will give him a dollar. So in this every way, they're encouraged. They have nothing to lose. The assumption is that will get rid of any blood spot that is found, you know, that they find. In terms of whether they'll bother to look for them or not, so again, it gives them an incentive to check. If they don't check, again, like we said, you know, blood spots are not so common. Of the blood spots that are out there, I forget the exact number, but it's close to 99% of them are removed by candling. As long as, again, that's only for the white. For the brown, the numbers go way down. But at least with the white eggs, they're And you know, a maker of din, there's really no need to check for it. It's a chumrah, so we try to keep that minig. And if they do find one, then we throw the whole egg away.
Okay, it's 5 o'clock United States time, 7 o'clock in Australia. A good Shabbos, and we'll be in touch about a future shiur.
Thank you very much. Shabbos.
Good Shabbos.
Thank you.